So we do often think about the Apollo missions as a way for the U.S. to one-up the USSR during the Cold War. But something I found interesting while reading your book was that JFK actually reached out to the Soviets in hopes of going to the moon together.
Repeatedly he did so. It's a pretty fascinating story that very few people are familiar with. I mean, within a few days after he had given the speech about going to the moon, his budget director is already telling him that, you know, it looks like NASA may break the bank on this one. And he met Khrushchev for their one and only summit in early June of 1961, just a few days after the announcement of the moon program, and proposed to Khrushchev that they turn this into a joint effort. Khrushchev's response was, well, that's something interesting to talk about, and we should do so, but we really need to handle some other things first, like a nuclear test ban treaty. So nothing came of it at that point. Relations between the U.S. and the Soviet Union soured in the latter part of 1961, and of course, reached a real low point with the Cuban Missile Crisis. Then back in 1963, issues had sort of resolved themselves a bit. Kennedy's really feeling the pressure politically from his left that he's spending too much money on this Apollo program, and he returns to the idea of turning it into a joint effort. And goes to the United Nations. This is a very public activity. Goes to the United Nations, gives a speech before the entire UN, proposing that they turn Apollo into a joint program with the Soviets.
To get to the moon, the United States had to set a clear goal and basically create all the technology required to get there.
Now, they had basic, you know, rockets at the time, of course, and ballistic missiles and so forth. But nothing had ever been built that was on the size and scale of a Saturn V, which was the moon rocket that carried the astronauts to the moon. I mean, a massive vehicle. Stood 363 feet tall. At first launch, it generated 7.5 million pounds of thrust. Truly remarkable. Nobody had ever done anything like this before. And it proved to be successful in astounding ways. I mean, the fact that there was never a failure of this rocket or even serious anomalies associated with it makes it incredibly remarkable. The Russians, by contrast, were trying to build their own version of a big moon rocket like the Saturn V. They called it the N1. They were never able to get it to work. They tried four test launches, and at the end of the fourth one, they just gave up on the whole thing. And that wasn't until we had already been to the moon. It was in the 1970s by then.
So after Apollo 11, you know, there was this phrase that if we can put a man on the moon, why can't we tackle any problems on Earth, or why can't we tackle X? What can Apollo's legacy tell us about the ability for science and technology to tackle problems on Earth in the 21st century?
Well, that question is still valid. If we can put a man on the moon, why can't we name the hard, difficult issue of your choice to solve? And if it's a science and technology question, we can do that. And there have been many instances in which we've applied that knowledge base to everyday problems here, but they have to be technological. You can't solve social problems by applying NASA's efforts to that issue. But if you want to solve the problems of transportation in the cities or the electronic grids or communication systems or any number of other things that are a part of our everyday lives, the exact same skill sets that were developed in Apollo and applied successfully there can be and have been and continue to be applied in all these other places. The story, again, I like to tell about this is about NASA's Mission Control Center. Everybody's seen the pictures and the video of all of these people sitting at consoles with big screens up in the distance as a mission is going on, and that's where they control everything. Every city today has at least one of those mission control centers monitoring its transportation grid, its electronics grid, its plumbing, its communication systems. All of those things are a part of how we manage a modern set of capabilities that are ubiquitous with us today, and that they're all modeled on NASA's mission control.
Being a millennial myself, I think it's easy to sometimes take for granted some of the amazing images captured by the Apollo astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
I find it incredible to think that, you know, before 1968, during Apollo 8, nobody had seen a photograph of the Earth from above before. Tell us a little bit about that image and some of the other famous images from Apollo 11 that you wrote about in your book.
Well, I think there's a half a dozen or so really kind of path-breaking images. And one of them is the Earthrise image from Apollo 8, where you see the lunar surface in the foreground, gray and lifeless, and hanging in the blackness of space in the distance is Earth. And this blue and white marble, which we all know is teeming with life, everything we've ever loved, everything we've ever hated, exists on that particular body. And it really did create an aha moment for all kinds of people as they saw that for the first time. And especially juxtaposed with the moon in the foreground, where, you know, you see that we are really on a spaceship ourselves. That's what the Earth is. And there aren't any lifeboats. And we better, you know, do a better job of taking care of it. And so the modern environmental movement really got a shot in the arm with that particular image. The Buzz Aldrin planting of the flag, Neil's off in the distance taking the picture so you don't see him in it. The truly remarkable thing about Apollo, and it was not lost on the rest of the world, I might add, was that they planted that flag and they said, "We came in peace for all mankind. This is something we did for all of us." Another one that I find in the same category is the boot print on the moon that Buzz Aldrin took a photograph of. He found that the surface right around the Apollo 11 landing site had a small amount of dust, although dust is sort of the wrong term. It was a very, very fine sifting sort of thing that you see there on the surface, and he put his boot in it and he took it away and he realized it made quite a striking boot print. So he took this picture of it. And what is remarkable about that picture in my mind is that since there's almost no seismic activity on the moon and there's no atmosphere, no water, none of those sorts of things, that boot print will be there eons from now, long after we are planet hopping to other solar systems.
With the possibility of going back to the moon, is anything being done to preserve those footprints?
So there's a number of activities along those lines to try to preserve the sites where human activity has taken place on the moon, and especially Tranquility Base, the Apollo 11 landing site. And it's a tall order. There's not been any formal success yet in trying to protect those sites. But there's a number of entities that are pushing this. We think that there may be some opportunity to pursue this further with the United Nations. The problem we've got is that no national entity has any jurisdiction over the moon, so we'll have to figure out how legally we might be able to preserve it. But I like to joke that I have already volunteered to become the first curator on the moon. I would be glad to put the ropes and stanchions around Tranquility Base to keep all the tourists who come away from destroying it, but NASA's not taken me up on that yet.
So your book has a chapter titled Apollo and the Religion of Spaceflight.
Right.
In it you write, quote, "Apollo represented, as much as anything else, a spiritual quest, a purification of humanity, and a search for absolution and immortality." Can you unpackage that statement for us?
Yeah, sure. When you start thinking about spaceflight, it has all the ingredients of a religion, if you will, a church, if you will. It has, most importantly, a salvation theology associated with it. In most of our conceptions of religion here on Earth, there's a sense of an afterlife, whatever form that might take, but some sort of an afterlife, and becoming immortal. And that's true for spaceflight as well, not for the individual, but for humankind as a whole. So as we become a multi-planetary species and we move from place to place to place in the universe, we have the opportunity then to continue our species beyond. And that's not true if we stay on this planet. There's absolutely 100% certainty that we will become extinct as long as we remain on this planet. Now, it may be billions of years in the future when the Earth becomes consumed by a red giant that will be the sun that expands. But at that point, we better be somewhere else or we're extinct.
Sure.
And that's the best case scenario. There are, of course, more immediate threats to our survival as a species. And some of those we might do to ourselves, like nuke each other or so foul the planet that we can't survive here, in which case we probably deserve to be extinct. But be that as it may, that salvation theology is a part of the idea of spaceflight and a part of what was behind Apollo as well.
So Apollo's legacy, or part of Apollo's legacy then, is the technology created to get to the moon in the mid-20th century is integral to, you know, the long-term survival of our species.
Of species, yeah. Right. Wow. Absolutely.
So with talk of going back to the moon and to Mars, we're on the cusp then of taking a next step of venturing out into the cosmic ocean, so to speak. Is it worth going back to the moon at this point and on to Mars? Well, what do you think?
I certainly think so. And I don't think it's going to be immediate that we do this. You know, the current administration has said we want to try to do it by 2024. Well, we may not quite make that. But if it's 2030, is that a problem? I don't believe so. The reality is that that there are many things that we can do on the moon. Some of them are resource utilization that we have discovered there in the based upon what we learned from Apollo and since, and we can take advantage of those resources. And that could be an enormous boon for humanity if we're able to do that. And we're not sure yet exactly what all is there and how easy it will be to obtain. But until we get back there, we're never going to know the answer to that question. So I would think that it's appropriate to try to find out.
Taking this back full circle to the Cold War, you conclude your book by kind of challenging this notion that Apollo 11 represents American nationalism and exceptionalism, even calling that sense of nationalism embarrassing in a postmodern global age.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that Apollo is many things, and it's many very positive things, but one of them is is not this sort of nationalistic pride and prestige that we're somehow better than all the other peoples of the world because we were able to do this. We were able to do it, obviously, and that's a pretty remarkable thing in and of itself. But us sort of running around 50 years after the fact and saying we're better than you because we did something when your grandparents were active is probably not the best lesson to learn. We have more things yet to do in the future, a lot of them in space, and we can do them. But forward thinking as opposed to sort of looking at past glories make more sense to me.
Sure. So, you know, as we expand into the solar system and beyond, it's probably going to take more of a global effort, would you say, not just one nation leading the way or as far as cost and stuff like that?
Yeah, absolutely. It may be the one nation leads the way, but it doesn't mean they're going to go it alone.
Okay.
I do think that any big space activity in the future is going to be a multinational effort, and not unlike the International Space Station is today, which has been a remarkable success. Regardless of anything else that comes from this, and there are many things that do, when people look back on the International Space Station 100 years from now, they're going to think about that international consortium of nation states that worked together over a long period of time, since the 1980s, to build and operate this vehicle in orbit. And with all of the difficulties that it might entail and all of the issues that had to be wrestled with over time, it's a pretty remarkable success story. I think that is a model for future space activities. I'd like to think it's the model for a lot of human activities, but certainly in space, I think if we go back to the moon, create a lunar base or perhaps multiple lunar bases, that's going to be an international consortium that does that.
If you have to sum up the legacy of Apollo 11 kind of briefly.
I guess one thing I would say about Apollo that is truly centered to its legacy is that it was born out of a Cold War crisis that was taking place, a global struggle for suzerainty over the world in which there was going to be a winner and a loser. And Apollo was established with the intention of demonstrating that the United States, and in those days it was just the United States acting alone here, had the capability to do these sorts of things while other nations did not. It did demonstrate that, and it created an environment in the Cold War that was strikingly different afterwards. A question to ask, I believe, is what if the United States had not won that space race? What if the Russians had been successful in reaching the moon first? Would it have changed the outcomes of the Cold War? And I would suggest it might well have, because everybody in the world was watching what was taking place. They all knew that the civilization that could master science and technology was going to lead the world into the future, and they wanted to be a part of that. Was it going to be a world led by the U.S. based upon a political and economic system that was open and democratic, or was it going to be led by a command economy and a militaristic system in the Soviet Union?